Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
And I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And we are very happy to be joined today by a guest. Do you mind introducing yourself?
My name is Mike Posner.
Mike Posner is in the studio.
Yeah.
You may know Mike from his work as a performer, songs like Cooler Than Me, I Took a Pill in Ibiza, and you may not know him as a songwriter of tracks like Boyfriend by Justin Bieber and Sugar by Maroon 5. I think this is going to be fun. We're going to dig into some of Mike's new music, and then, well, we'll see where things take us. But let's begin with a little listening. Let's listen to some of Mike's new track, Song About You. Mike, will you tell us just a little about the development of this track?
Yeah, sure. I did this one with Dan Wilson and Ricky Reed,
cool,
who did my album. And we had a few days in the studio that I was actually a little frustrated about, because I came to Ricky, who executive produced my album, with about 50 some odd songs that I'd been writing the last year or two. And I needed his help finding the album in that mountain of music.
Yeah.
And he's really skilled at that. So we listened to all his music, and he said, we got the songs. And, we picked like 10 of them or something. And so I was thinking we were going to like work on them, record them and produce them. And then after that day, he was like, and now we're going to write more songs.
What?
I was like, and I was pissed. I was like, man, I don't know. That's the last thing I need is more songs. But he was like, I always do this just to see if there's anything left.
Huh.
But he hadn't told me that he always does it just to see if anything. I was just in there and I was kind of like, what are we doing, man?
Yeah.
We need more songs, man. So anyways, we worked all day in the studio, Dan, Ricky, and I. We had some ideas. Nothing that really revealed itself as special to any of the three of us, and you know, it was about maybe 5:30, 6 p.m.
Yeah.
And Dan, the day was like pretty much over. Dan was like, "All right, I'm gonna leave soon." We're like, "Yeah, cool." And right when he was about to leave, he picked up one of Ricky's guitars and started playing. And Ricky, I looked at each other like, what's that?
Cool.
And then Ricky just took his iPhone out and recorded Dan playing it was an electric guitar, but he just recorded him playing it live with his iPhone. And then I think he sent that to himself, and then Dan did indeed leave. And Ricky made his awesome track out of the voice note. And then we just started writing to it, and Dan sort of came back. We had like a song to his riff.
So Dan
came back the next day.
Gotcha. Yeah. So that riff was sort of the origin point of the whole
tune. Correct.
Form, lyrics, melody, that all like sort of accreted as you worked on it.
Yeah.
Is there a specific order in which you start to add those elements, or is it?
There's no formula, but I can tell you kind of how it happened with this song.
But I'd love
with
to hear
that.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just make it real clear. It's definitely not this way for every
right,
song.
Right.
Not
sure.
Even close. I've written songs every way. Yeah. For this one, he started to, you know, those things that I just said happened, and I think we had the hook first. And I was really into like not rhyming, you know. I've done like a lot of rhyming in my career, and sometimes it gets in the way. You know, I did a book of poetry, and I found in some ways poetry was a lot more real or like harder in like a Detroit sort of way. It's harder in that, I don't mean more difficult, I mean it's like grittier because you just say it. So we're playing around with not rhyming a lot, and I think that's really what makes the song dope to me still, is when I listen like in the first verse and say, since you've been gone, ain't got nothing to do. I sleep until noon, I wake up and feel bad.
Yeah.
That should rhyme, but it doesn't. And that's really awesome to me.
Yeah.
And then I think I just went in the booth and, I was just sort of freestyling.
Yeah.
And that's when I got the, I just want to unwind everything that makes me feel confined.
Yeah.
Sometimes I hate sunshine sometimes. So I think that just like came out. I was just like kind of rapping, singing.
Yeah, let's actually, we have that queued up. Let's listen to that. This is sort of I guess a pre-chorus basically.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's sort of that. This is all emerging, sort of organically.
Yeah, I think we had the hook. Then I went in the booth, and I was just doing stuff.
Yeah,
freestyling, and I freestyled that amongst I think a bunch of other things. And Ricky tagged that, marked that, and we used it originally for the bridge. I had this long, meandering. It was really like a rant. We used to call it Psycho Michael.
Yeah.
And it's just me like basically complaining. We had that there for months and months and months. And it was months later, we're finishing up the album. I'm like, that rant sucks. It was a cool idea, but we need a bridge. So we're at like the final 11th hour, you know. And then I was like, you know what? It was actually like late at night. Usually we work days. I'm a day guy. So I like to, start. I actually like to start as early as possible. If Ricky would have done it, I would have started at 7 a.m.
Is that hard to find collaborators willing to work?
Yeah. Yeah. In L.A. I heard in Nashville they start earlier. But in L.A., yeah. Typically it's like 2 p.m. starts, a lot of times.
Must be nice.
It is. Well, yeah. And then people work later.
Yeah, for sure.
Know?
Of course.
Yeah, it was late one night. We were finishing the album at this point. We needed a bridge, man. So I was like, I was goofing around. And another one of our collaborators, Nate Mercerow, who produced a lot of my album, he works with Ricky. He used to wear these shades and leave them on the table. And I stole the shades. I put them on. I was just messing around. I'm like, man, Hollywood Pose is in the building. What up, y'all? You know how I do it. Want to give a shout out to all my homies in Detroit. And everyone's like sort of laughing at me. And I was like, man, cue up that bridge. Just hit record. I'll do the rest, man. And so you're recording. I did the bridge. And so I did a style that I learned from Wiz Khalifa, which you don't write anything down. I don't think we wrote anything down for this song. Huh. But this way, I explicitly got this from Wiz, which was, I would get into the booth, I record the first line, stop. I think of the second line, I go, okay, I'm ready. I record the second line, stop. I think of the third line, okay, I'm ready. Third line, and just I did the whole verse like that. You never write anything down.
With that kind of intuitive writing style, what do you think we're getting as listeners?
I don't know. I mean, it saves a step, right? It's a little less cerebral, yeah. I presume, and maybe a bit more instinctive.
Right.
So I'd like to think you're getting something more raw and less thought out.
Sure, sure.
Which is a color you want to have on your palette.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do everything that way because sometimes I want it to sound like I thought about it, but sometimes not. So in that bridge and not this whole song kind of is. It's not overly lyrical or pedantic or not like cool words or imagery. It's like, this is just what it is.
Yeah.
This is how I feel.
So I have a lot of thoughts about that, the immediacy and the intimacy, I guess, of what you're describing. And what you said earlier too about the rhyme scheme, I definitely want to come back to that.
Sure.
So we're gonna circle back around. Let's I want to get it into more of like what gives this song that sense of in your face immediacy, that it's unfiltered or something. It's a little raw. Like those, I think we have those qualities in like some of the production, the way Ricky Reed's drums are a little crunchy and even staticky. But there's also, I think it's also happening on like some more scalar levels in terms of the realm of form. So I want to dig into the form of the song a little bit, because I think there's something cool happening here. And to me, that is really crystallized in the way you've structured this song, in which the chorus and the verses have the exact same melody. And so I wanted to like spend some time on this idea and think about how that generates a kind of a certain kind of power in the song. So first, let's just listen to this. We can hear it from the very top because the song starts with a chorus, and then it'll move into the first verse. So it's a great way to you can hear that the melody stays the same even though the lyrics change.
Correct.
So let's have a listen to that one more time. Now we get the verse with the same melody, new lyrics. Since you've been gone, ain't got nothing to do. I sleep until noon, I wake up and feel bad. I think I missed something I never had. So this song is far from alone in using this technique of reusing the same melody for verse and chorus. And again, I think it's like this does a very specific thing. This makes music into something like kind of an intense, kind of like almost like reciting a mantra or something. You know, there's like this power to it. And I think that might be because it connects us to like older forms of music making, religious forms of music making, and like folk forms. Going back to some of the earliest styles you'd hear in America, these would be folk songs imported from like the British Isles, and they would use just the same melody over and over again with different lyrics, kind of like a ballad form, you know, telling a story. A very like a hugely popular one was this tune called Barbary Allen, which has a million different versions, but they'll all follow the same pattern, same melody, new lyrics. Let's listen to a little bit.
All in the merry month of May, when the green buds they were swelling, young William Green on his deathbed lay for the love of Barbary Allen.
Same melody, new words.
He sent his servant to the town, to the place where she was dwelling, saying, "Master's sick and he sends for you, if your name be Barbary Allen."
What stands out to me hearing this is that in a lot of contemporary music, our verses tend to have simpler melodies so that you can build to a more potent melody in the hook. Not always, but as a general heuristic. And here, you're getting basically the hook as the verse, just as you're doing in your song. And there's something very hypnotic about it, as you pointed
out. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was swept away by her voice. Oh, I wasn't paying too much about
that. That's Gene Ritchie singing that song. Incredible.
Sounds incredible.
And it's, it connects us also to a lot of religious music, too. I'm thinking of maybe songs like Amazing Grace, which we know, but we can listen to a cool version of this in a sort of Sacred Harp style.
Yeah, it's never too much. Yeah. Amazing Grace, man.
Well said.
It sounds like an accordion.
Totally, yeah. Yeah. So then we get same music, new lyrics.
It also reminds me of the big Kanye vocal that yeah. you can also hear on, like, I was just listening to
it's the Bon Iver.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
It has that, because there's so many singers and it's so tight and almost mechanical, it has that sort of auto-tune with the sub-bass sound in it, yeah. except it's a chorus.
Whoa.
I think they use like a rack where you can play on the keyboard the notes that you want the other voices to sing. Mm. And you can, like, you know, there's a million parameters of how right. many you want it to do. And
right.
This is the analog version of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. This is a tradition called sacred harp or shape note singing. And yeah, it's very, I like what the word you use, Charlie, hypnotic sort of. Yeah, it's very, you can see how it's connected to prayer and sort of getting into some sort of trance state. The same mm-hmm. music over and over again mm-hmm. tends to do that. And we can give this old style and kind of old fashioned name strophic form, like strophes. You mentioned writing poetry earlier. Strophe is just kind of another word for a stanza. So it's the idea that you repeat the same stanza over and over again, I guess, in terms of music. Huh. So as we move into pop,
yeah.
I think this idea starts to get translated into, you know, the language of pop music. And where in these old folk and religious songs, you just have the same music over and over again, pop music might tend to vary it up a little bit. But we can still hear this, I think, in songs that use the same melody for the verse and the chorus. And a great example is Prince's I Wanna Be Your Lover.
Mm.
I ain't got no money. I ain't got those other guys you hang around. It's kind of funny. But they always seem to let you down.
Now he's going to break it up with a pre-chorus. And now we're at the chorus, but it's the same melody as the verse.
Gosh, that's satisfying.
Yeah. So a very different world than Amazing Grace. And yet I think that technique still holds its power. You know, there's something like captivating about hearing the same melody over and over and over again. It's not a flaw of these songs. It's like, it's a strength, right?
Correct.
Yeah. One of the things with the song about you that stood out for me is the first time I listened through, I went back and I was like, wait, hold on. I got to go find the hook. I was like, wait, okay, I'm like looking for that like big build. Where's that hook happening? And then I was like, oh, it's all a hook.
The hook is all around you.
It's happening all the time. And it was
you
kind of
are in the hook.
Let's listen. This might be overkill, but let's listen. Prince does this also on the song Let's Go Crazy. We can just check that out real quick.
Never too much Prince either.
No, never. No, never. Don't lie. Where's your living here? Take a look around. At least you got friends. I call my old lady. And then we have a pre-chorus that mixes it up. And then we're back to the same melody, but with the chorus lyrics.
Yeah.
Now, Prince is a master at this, but he's not alone. There's another really cool example of this from sort of pop of yore in Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run.
Yeah.
So it'll start right on the chorus and it's going to the verse, but the music doesn't change.
That man's town. I think this was the second take I read.
Oh, really?
In his book, I can't remember. Early take. I think they did it. Yeah, I think it was the second take.
On to take.
Yep.
Same melody, right? I think I misspoke earlier. It starts with a verse and then goes to a chorus and then goes to a verse. And while the lyrics change, the music stays the same. And it's so effective, right?
Yeah.
part of what works on this one for me is the verses have more syllables, and they're, whereas the chorus, when he's finally sings Born in the USA, it's the exact same melody, but he's drawing out each of the notes. So it kind of sounds anew.
There is also another factor to this working.
Ooh, yeah.
The lyrics have to be good. And furthermore, if you had lyrics you really loved that you wanted to highlight, that might be a reason to do this technique. Because when you switch a melody, the listener's ear goes to the melody. Whereas, you know, like the first example you play, when it's just the same melody over and over, you can, as a listener, you can zero in on the lyrics and hear them. So if I had something where I'm like, man, these lyrics are hot, I want people to hear them, which is usually the last thing people hear when they listen. Mm. Usually hear melody, the texture of the song. Then, you know, if they like those things on a third, on a fourth listen, they might get into more lyrics.
Yeah.
Mm. So yeah, if I had some words that were important to me, I might employ that. I might be more likely to employ this sort of strophic technique.
Mike.
You can't get away with using the same melody and having an uninspired second verse, because you're actually going to have bored somebody as opposed to, hey, tune in.
Correct.
Mm.
So conversely, if you have some lyrics you're like not really that proud of, maybe you sort of cover it up with a lot of melodic changes.
Let's really take the song in a different direction.
Nah, well, we have some album rules.
Yeah.
And they're like, maybe there were six of them. We'd post them on the wall. One is in the no filler lyrics anywhere on the album. Mm. This takes time.
Yeah.
You know, and you being honest with yourself. Mm. Like, you said that because it rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you know that in your heart. There's none of those moments left on my album. It took months to get rid of all of them.
Yeah.
You know, so that was like rule number one. There's a bunch of other rules, like no roundhouse kicks in the control room. But
I didn't realize that was a common issue in the music industry.
It's not common. Just my sessions can get a little
Street Fighter.
Yeah, little
intense. I love that. Let's listen to one more example of this technique of using the same melody for both verse and chorus. This is in one of the most popular songs of recent vintage. Mm. I won't introduce it. We'll just listen. You're going to hear the chorus first and then the verse with the same exact music. I've been popping, popping, man, I feel just like a rock
star. All my brothers got, I love this song so much.
Yeah.
I heard this, it was like a first listen I heard. I was like, I love it.
Cool.
I'm going to Spotify. When my homies pull up on your block, they make that thing go grata
da da. Switch my whip, came back in black. So now we're in the verse. Same melody. Smoke, she asked me light a fire like I'm awesome. Act a fool on stage, probably leave my show. In a cop car.
Dope lyrics.
And I think this is, you know, this song is incredibly successful. And I think that's a big part of it. It just, like, that word you use, Charlie, hypnotic, keeps on coming back to me. This song puts you in a trance. It's like waving
the pendulum,
you know, in front
of
your eyes.
Big part of it.
Yeah.
The melody itself is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And the words are great.
Yeah.
And they made a smart decision, which is never, don't go away from that until there's the one part
where he
which
kinda,
is a pre.
Right.
And that's timed perfectly. It happens right when you would have got bored with the melody. And then it brings the melody back right after that sort of pre-chorus section.
Yeah.
I just want to highlight, you know, the strophic technique does not work without having a melody worth repeating, right? Mm-hmm. You know,
no doubt. And as you mentioned, you know, those moments of variation that give the listener like a little break.
Yeah, and they timed in the right way. Yeah. Like with Bruce, who was verse, hook, verse, hook, verse, hook. And with this is much hook.
Right.
And verse, long, and pre-chorus, and then back. That melody.
Get one little breather.
Yeah, you got to figure that out with each song in the studio. Mm.
There's a balance to it. I like that. Okay, I want to transition now from musical form to that conversation we were having earlier about rhyme scheme. Think about how these two things are related in terms of the song telling you a story. So let's go exactly to that place you were talking about, Mike. The rhyme scheme does not do the things you expect it to do. Let's listen to the chorus first, because this does have a very clear rhyme scheme. Put all your stuff in a box in my room. I don't want to write no song about you, but you show up in everything that I do. Yeah. So A, or I should say ooh, 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 ooh.
Yeah.
Right? Very clear. But then we get to verse one, and there's this moment where things start to go off the rails a little bit. Since you've been gone, ain't got nothing to do. I sleep until noon, I wake up and feel bad. I think I miss something I never had.
Oh, that's uncommon.
Yeah.
You've carried the rhyme scheme over from the chorus into the verse, and then you destroyed it.
Yeah.
That moment of bad is like, to me,
it's the best moment.
Oh yeah, no, it's the moment where the whole song just kind of like turns and you're like, "Oh, whoa, this is going in a different direction than I anticipated." And that word bad, you know, it has a lot of meaning.
And it's not clever at all. But it's why it's good. It's cuz it's the right word.
Yeah.
It's the right word, but it's not clever, but it's how I felt. So say it.
Truth is more important than rhyme, yeah.
I always believe this. I don't know why, but I've always believed this.
Yeah.
I remember this song I wrote in college. This was 10 years ago now. It was about my first crush. Somewhere I had the line like 2000, and I was talking about the year 2000. Yeah. But I could have said 2004 and it would have rhymed. But I didn't. I just said 2000 because it was true. And so I've just sort of stuck with that ever since, that the truth matters more, I think.
I have, you know? Sorry, I just have to, this is becoming a very sort of poetic session here, but I just, when you were saying that, Mike, I thought of this line from Keats, from the poem, In Drear.
Who's Keats? Never heard of him.
Oh, John Keats?
I'm just joking.
Oh, come on, yeah, come on, this is... We got a poem in our midst.
I don't know this poem, though.
This is the end of the poem. The feel of not to feel it when there is none to heal it, nor numbed sense to steal it, was never said in rhyme.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So, oh, sorry.
Chance the Rapper said, sometimes the truth don't rhyme.
Sometimes the truth don't rhyme. Whoa. From Keats to Chance.
I think that, you know, you were saying that feeling bad is, there's nothing clever about the line, except when paired with the expectation of where we're going, it becomes extremely clever.
Well, talk about expectation. Okay, so let's get back into the overall, the global arc of this, of these chorus and verses. So chorus is ooh, 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 right? Verse one is ooh, ad, ad, ooh. So like A, B, B, A. Now let's listen to the second verse. Now it's a cold war. Who will call first? Try to. And now in this second and final verse, we have a verse where nothing rhymes. It's A, B, C, D. So looking at the arc over the course of the thing, it's like chorus all rhymes, half of the verse, first verse rhymes, and then nothing rhymes in the second verse, which is cool because then it creates this sense of like deterioration almost. And at this point, I think we can acknowledge that it's not like this is a, you know, maybe a... It's like a somewhat bitter song, right? Or it's capturing a certain mood of like...
angry.
Yeah.
Confused and angsty.
Yeah, totally. And the rhyme scheme is like giving you that, even if you don't realize it. It's the rhyme scheme is the rhyme scheme is breaking down.
I didn't realize
over the course
it.
Of the song.
and it works decomposing. It works with in the second verse where you're having trouble paying attention at work. And the rhymes are breaking down. It's like you're almost like the mind is sort of scattered, and it connects to the rhyme scheme or lack thereof.
You guys are smart.
we just thank you. But you just like, it's cool. You know, when you listen to a song over and over and over again, things emerge that you miss the first time. That's one of the things I love about doing the show. It's like the rewards of repeated close listening.
Oh, yeah.
Know?
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break, read some ads, come right back, and I want to talk about how this song fits into the life cycle of a musician.
So there's a buzzy gift on everyone's list this year that I want to tell you about. It's something that they'll use twice every day. It was featured on Oprah's O List, and it's perfect for everyone with a, forgive me, a mouth. This gift is Quip, an electric toothbrush designed to make brushing better. And if you're traveling for the holidays, this is even better because Quip makes holiday travel clean and easy with a multi-use cover that mounts to mirrors and unmounts to slide over the bristles for on-the-go brushing. And Quip is the gift that keeps refreshing, with brush heads automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. And you can even gift prepaid refills for a year to make sure they're never using old, worn out, or ineffective bristles. Quip has over 5,000 verified 5-star reviews and looks like a big ticket tech gift with a stocking stuffer price starting at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/onpop, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush, but you don't have to tell your giftee that. That's the first refill pack free at getquip.com/onpop. That's getquip.com/onpop.
All right, we're back with Mike Posner. We just broke down some of the musical and lyrical tricks at play in his new track, Song About You. Now I want to step back from this particular song and think about maybe what this song represents in your career.
I want to interject one thing.
Interject away.
They're not tricks in that none of the stuff that you said was thought about.
Right.
It was all instinctual. Mm-hmm. There's just things that felt right in the studio at the time. So yeah, I just wanted to clarify.
No, I appreciate that. Let's say the mix of intuition, calculation, improvisation.
Well, and then it's really cool hearing how it plays out for you.
Yeah.
For me. But I wasn't sitting there thinking, I want to make this rhyme scheme deteriorate over the song. I didn't think that. But it does do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just doing what my gut told me to do.
I think oftentimes our intuition, it knows where to go. Both because
correct.
You're a trained songwriter. So you have an intuition of where a song needs to feel that does come from having written a lot of songs. And oftentimes the first gut feel of where it needs to go is exactly what the listener is also wanting and needing, what the song is needing. The overthinking it can often cause a different kind of deterioration.
Yeah, I was going to say the training maybe can get in the way sometimes.
Sure.
Huh. You know, you really want to abandon that with each tune and just address it individually. And are my only guiding light in this stuff is my gut.
Yeah.
I mean, for every decision as far as like how much reverb there is on a vocal or, you know, every musical production decision and, you know, the order of the tracks and the transitions and how long the album should be, if this song should be on the album, it's all gut. This is all I have to go on. And yeah, that's all I do go on.
Yeah.
Yeah. The mind is the enemy, sort of.
In this
stuff.
That could be another rule on the wall.
Perhaps. I mean, it's just like if you catch yourself in your mind rationalizing why something is good, it's not actually good. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing that.
You wouldn't have to work.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And that is just, I mean, look, that's like, I tell people all the time, that is the number one. And I'm sorry if I'm like going off on a tangent. It's just, I mean, it's simple. It's like, your key to success is just not convincing yourself something is done when it's not, or something is good when it's not. And you just have to, you know, be like a watchdog on your own mind.
Do you feel, is that a place that you've gotten to, or is that a place that you've always resided? Do you know what I mean?
I've gotten more comfortable there.
Yeah.
I've always been there when I'm alone. Sometimes when I was younger and I worked with other people, I'd be afraid of disappointing them or upsetting them or something like this, which is probably why I like working alone.
Yeah.
But as I've gotten older and just matured, I'm much more comfortable staying there with other people.
I want
like, hey, this isn't, sorry. I know we thought this was done, but it is not, you know?
Maybe that word mature is something we can explore for a minute, because you know I don't put much stock in physical appearance, but I do have to note, Mike, that you have entered the beard phase of your career.
Man, you'd be happy I wasn't here 2 weeks ago.
Really? What was 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, I've trimmed my beard.
Oh yeah, I've seen it. Was like you had like birds living in there.
Yeah,
and stuff.
It was all in.
Yeah. But you still got some nice structure.
Have some volume.
There. Yeah, some volume, totally. Beard phase. There, I love that. This to me is like maybe a nice metaphor for this sort of maturation that people experience as artists, you know, like sort of entering a new phase or something, a new level, a new moment of creativity. I thought it'd be interesting to step back and think about the beard phase a little bit in a sort of macro sense, because I think it is interesting. I was thinking about the song and like its you know role in the arc of your career, Mike, and how we do tend to think of musicians as like having these phases, you know, sort of like some early like juvenile period where you're figuring stuff out, some middle period where you like have your real success, and then some late period where you start to explore new ideas and kind of go into something maybe more avant-garde. And the composer who I think really set the template for this way of thinking about cycles of creativity was
Beethoven.
Charlie knows the answer. When in doubt, the answer is Beethoven.
Wow.
So you're gonna take us on a ride through some classical masters.
But a quick ride.
Yeah.
Short trip.
I don't know. This is cool. Keep it coming.
Beethoven is like, you know, we begin, and he sounds very much like a Viennese.
He's in Germany?
He's in Austria. In
Austria?
Vienna. Yeah.
And what year is it?
He's born in Germany.
What year is it?
This is, we're going to start right at the turn of the 19th century, 1801,
okay.
Actually. So this is like...
not that long ago.
No, not that long
Pop
ago.
Pop music changes in not very long time.
Yeah, no, Mozart just died like, yeah, at the end of the middle of the 1790s.
I thought Mozart came after.
No, Beethoven actually moved to Vienna to study with Mozart.
Who came for Mozart? Who was his hero?
Mozart's hero was actually Johann Christian Bach.
That's what I'm thinking about.
Not Johann Sebastian, but Johann Sebastian's son, Johann Christian.
Okay.
Hasn't made it through time as well.
Yeah. now the Bach we know in his day was kind of he was kind of like rediscovered much later.
Gotcha.
In the mid 1800s by Felix Mendelssohn, actually. And then everyone's like, oh, now we love the OG Bach, you know? And then they kind of forgot about his son.
Dang.
So Beethoven, let's check in on him. He sounds, in the beginning of his career, 1801, he still sounds a lot like Mozart. Really, we can have a listen. It's very elegant.
He studied with Mozart.
He was going to, but then Mozart died. He ended up working with Haydn, Franz Joseph Haydn, instead. So, you know, don't feel too bad for him.
Okay, so this is early Beethoven.
Yeah.
How old was he?
Beethoven was
ballpark
in 17. I think he was born in. I don't want to misquote this, but I think he was born in the 1770s. So he's probably like in his mid 20s now. Yeah, lovely, right?
There's a lot that's Beethoven there. The sequencing of melodies rather than letting melodies sort of play out, but that ending little cadence felt very Mozartian.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, and that it all starts on this unison chord without any harmonies, yeah. Let's jump ahead now to 1809. So we're just going to listen to string quartets. So that was the first string quartet. Let's jump ahead to the 10th string quartet now.
How old is he?
So now he's like approaching 30.
Hard.
What? It's like almost falling apart.
Now we're in the middle period, in the what's sometimes called the heroic period. This is like Beethoven becoming capital B Beethoven. And this is when he writes the Fifth Symphony. Da, 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 da.
Is this Beard Phase?
No, we're not.
It's right before Beard Phase.
Very good, Mike. Pre-beard. And we can start to hear, it's like, it sounds like his style, these contrasts of like really loud and then really soft textures, yeah. Really slow and then really fast textures, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so now we enter Beard Phase. This is this doesn't have a name. This is called the Grosse Fuga. This is known as one of his kind of craziest, most out there pieces from right before the end of his life.
This is Beard Phase.
This is Beard Phase, yeah. This Whoa. Is getting intense. This is like, it's not as accessible.
Does this mean I'm about to die?
No, and I had a professor who hated that we called it Beethoven's late period. Exactly for that reason. He was like, Beethoven didn't know he was going to die. It's not like he was like, oh, now I'm going to enter my late period.
But he might have felt older.
Certainly. Well, towards the end of his life, he was, you know, getting sick. But I mean, who knows? He could have had more phases.
Yeah,
right?
I understand.
He could have had a post-beard phase.
Correct.
Yeah. So, twirly mustache phase.
Yeah.
Which happens. I don't shave the beard.
I don't mean to deny any of our mortality, but I think you're good.
Some productive years ahead.
Actually, this is a great point, because beard phase is a metaphor. Anyone can enter beard phase, and beard phase is not the end of your career.
Some people start in beard phase.
Ooh, who starts in beard phase?
Hmm.
Let's ponder that.
Iron and wine.
Yeah. Is anyone that they seemingly don't need the maturation process?
Yeah.
They just come out sort of like
that's interesting.
Going like they just don't.
Or
care.
What about artists who like start in like a more difficult, weird place and then become more accessible over their career?
Correct. Someone like St. Vincent, for example, would be perfect. Where like her early music, it's challenging and interesting and great, but
out
it's not
there.
Hooky, catchy, and pop radio friendly.
Oh, reverse beard phase. Yeah. Interesting. I was thinking that Beethoven might have a parallel in contemporary pop music.
I can't even.
Who's the answer to any other question on this show?
Taylor Swift.
Yep. All right, let's start in the early phase. This is 16-year-old Taylor Swift doing Teardrops on My Guitar.
Drew looks at me. I bake a smile so he won't see that I want.
I mean, it's a great song, but it also, it's like, you can tell she's still figuring it out, you know? Or to me, at least. I feel like this is not, you know, the crystallization. Taylor Swift really emerges, I think, on an album like Red. Let's jump ahead to that. Middle phase.
Hero?
Heroic phase, exactly.
Hero phase.
Heroica.
I'm gonna pass Nate's class.
Seriously.
Pass? I'm gonna get A.
Extra credit.
Needed space. What? Then you come around again and say, baby, I miss you and I swear I'm gonna change. Trust me. Remember how that lasted for a day? I say, I hate you. We break up. You call me. I love you.
I forgot she did country.
Oh, yeah.
When you played the first song. Oh, yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
It makes me realize we just did an episode a little while ago on where country is going. And I feel like country music is catching up to Red. Where it's like this blend where it's like kind of country. It's like maybe got one hint of like acoustic guitar, but it's really moving into like there's sweeping EDM stuff.
And, the Max Martin.
So you listen to this and it's like, yeah, this is her sound. She's mastered who she is. And you can hear it in the little asides and the conversationality of the lyrics.
That takes confidence.
Absolutely. It's like, yeah, that's Taylor Swift. These are the smash years, the heroic age, and then beard phase.
This sounds a lot like Yeezus.
Right?
Oh, interesting.
Right here.
Yeah, I guess it kind of does.
He was a killer, first time that I saw him. Wonder how many girls he had
stuffed and left haunted. But if he's a ghost, then I can be a phantom holding him for ransom.
So now we're in the late phase, the beard phase. It's more challenging. It's like difficult. It's not quite as accessible. This is a pattern that I imagine artists will continue to live out again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in honor of your beard, Mike, I want to just like quickly celebrate some other great beard phase moments in musical history.
Okay.
And I think the classic one is the Beatles, right? You know, yes. They go from yes. the clean cut, you know, boys in matching suits to the psychedelic bearded mustachioed freaks. let's listen to Strawberry Fields Forever.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields.
I've got another gray beard in Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. You know, think of the Beach Boys again, yep. clean cut, matching striped shirts. And then he goes into his sort of offbeat Charles Manson associated spacey druggy phase.
He's associated with Charles Manson?
He hung with Charles a little bit, yeah. But he also cut a great album in 1977, which, go Google it, full on beard. Pacific Ocean Blue. Let's listen to River Song.
Wow.
Yeah, man.
Dope.
Yeah, the beard.
That's dope.
The beard is symbolic, right? The beard represents like
acid.
Do you have something you'd like to share with us?
What does the beard represent for you, Mike? Or is that reading too much into it?
No, I mean, are we talking about the beard that we've established in this conversation or mine?
Let's talk about yours. Yeah,
because there's some overlap, but not
right. Totally.
And I think it, for me, is like a proclamation that I don't care about looking or being cool anymore, which I do care about, but it's like a reminder.
Yeah.
It's an aspirational proclamation, I guess.
Cool.
Maybe an affirmation. I don't know. You probably think of a better word.
No, I like that.
What I'm trying to say, though?
Yeah. Is there a musical corollary?
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, look, people have the beard phase or post-heroic phase, whatever you want to call it, because in the heroic phase, they experience success, notoriety, prestige, attention from the opposite sex, attention from the same sex, and these are the things that are supposed to make their life full and complete. And so often they don't. At least in my case, it didn't. I was the same guy with different circumstances around me. Like that phrase, you know, wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah.
Right? That was it. I felt the same way. My experience of life, it didn't really get worse, but it didn't get better. But I was disillusioned by these things that I thought were the end of the road, not being the end of the road. Hmm. So the question is, where Dave Foster Wallace got into his question is, if not that, then what?
Yeah.
Then what is life? If I'm not supposed to keep chasing success, prestige, notoriety, attention from same sex, attention from the opposite sex, then what do I do? And that's what the beard phase is about, is asking that question and like bushwhacking your way through existence and figuring out what really matters, if anything really matters.
Cool. So that makes me excited to hear more of your music, Mike. I can't think of a better note to end on than that. Except maybe I have one more beard.
And
I don't want to subscribe to the notion this is like, again, like a masculine thing. The beard is a metaphor, right?
Correct.
But for some artists, maybe it is a literal beard. I'm thinking of, do you know Peaches' album?
No.
Father Effer.
No.
Do you know Peaches?
Yeah.
Okay, let's just listen to
Hit Me.
The song Kick It from Father Effer featuring Iggy Pop.
You gotta handle that stuff.
You have to explain yourself.
Okay, so Right, I forgot we're doing a podcast. Because the cover of this album is Peaches with a full-on, like, Abraham Lincoln-style beard.
Dope.
So, and it's this beautiful reminder, I think, that everyone can have their beard face.
Right on.
Thanks for listening to Switched on Pop. This episode was produced by me, Nate Sloan.
And me, Charlie Harding.
Huge thanks to Mike Posner for joining us. That was so much fun. Anything you want to plug, Mike? Any shows, records, etc.?
Nah.
Great.
Our engineering and editing is done by Bill Lance. Our community manager is Sarah Terry, and designed by Luke Harris.
Check out more episodes, switchedonpop.com. You can find us on Radio Public, Apple Podcast app, Spotify, anywhere else you get that stuff.
And send us notes on Instagram and on Twitter at switchedonpop. We love to hear your thoughts about music.
We'll see you in 2 weeks. Until then, thanks for listening.